Welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in this Word Magazine episode 117, I'm going to be looking at the topic of what are called conjectural emendations. And I'm doing this in follow-up to recent discussions that I had in Word Magazine's 114 and 115 that were spurred by comments made by Calvinistic apologist James White in the lecture that he gave at Covenant Baptist Seminary on, supposedly on the TR, ended up being pretty much a review of a Twitter exchange. And statements that were made in that lecture and in the Twitter exchange on the text of Revelation 16:5 and the supposed conjectural emendation that was made there by Theodore Beza in his 1598 Greek text, and then the way that this was picked up in the King James Version. And I actually wrote the notes for this Word Magazine a long time back, several weeks back. I think the last Word Magazine was at the end of January, and today is February 16. And I just hadn't gotten around to sitting down. I'm still interested in the topic and some of the discussion that came out of the question of what is the proper text of Revelation 16:15. Is the use of conjectural emendation ever warranted? Is it never warranted? Must we have extant Greek manuscripts to support every reading? I think it's a fascinating question. And I think I noted when I did some review interaction with James White's lecture that I was sort of surprised that at the end of that lecture, he essentially rejected any conjectural emendations at all in text criticism of the New Testament. And I was surprised because he embraces the modern critical text method. And let me just, I've got his video here on YouTube queued up, and let me just play the part where he talks about rejecting all conjectural emendations. So here we go.
Little inconsistency. Last one. This is also about conjectural emendations, and two in the Nestle Allen 28, which I reject. I reject all conjectural emendation. I do not believe there is any need for conjectural emendation whatsoever. And tomorrow we'll talk about CBGM. CBGM has introduced a conjectural emendation. I reject it. And I'll.
All right. So he said, I reject all conjectural emendations. I do not believe there is any need for conjectural emendations whatsoever. And then he said, the CBGM, which is the coherence-based genealogical method, which is the new method of text criticism, has been developed in Germany at the Institute for the Study of the Text in the New Testament. That he notes that they have introduced conjectural emendations, meaning in the current Nestle-Aland 28th edition, which is the state-of-the-art scholarly text, scholarly handbook. He said, I reject it. Now, I don't know if he means by I reject it that he rejects the Nestle-Aland 28th edition in favor of earlier editions, the 27th or the 26th or something like that, or if he's just saying he rejects the places where the Nestle-Aland 28th following the coherence-based genealogical method has introduced conjectural emendations. He says too, and he's definitely referring to 2 Peter 3:10 and also one in Acts. So I was puzzled by that, and I mentioned it in my previous review, because it seems to me to be inconsistent to say, for James White to say that he rejects all conjectural emendations, because in my view, it seems in reading the material that conjectural emendations is presented as something that is essential and foundational to the methodological approach of modern text criticism, based as it is on the assumption that the text of Scripture has been hopelessly corrupted in the course of its transmission, and now it must be reconstructed by modern scholars using modern scientific methodology. Think about Bruce Metzger's classic textbook that influenced so many, including James White. The title of it is The Text of the New Testament, and the subtitle is Its Transmission, Corruption, and Restoration. So if the text of the Bible was transmitted, in the course of that transmission it was hopelessly corrupted, and then only in the modern era, only since the 19th century, has it been restored, the restoration process, as I have understood it, as has been put forward by advocates of modern text criticism, would be that sometimes the restoration process would involve conjectural emendation. They might be limited. It might be only in rare cases. Some may say, you know, they can't even point to any place where it might definitively have to be used, but it's a part of the methodology that must be embraced if you embrace whole hog the reconstructionist method. And so I want to do, two things. First of all, this whole subject sent me back to some of the texts that, not biblical texts, but works of scholarship on text criticism, on modern text criticism. And I went back through and surveyed several of them just to see what they say about the whole issue of conjectural emendations. And so I'm gonna flow through these. And by the way, as usual, at my blog, jeffriddle.net, I will have a post on Word Magazine 117. And if you want to read some of these quotations in full, you can go and look at them there. And I'm going to have to be selective. I can see how someone could say, well, you know, you chose this that, you know, Metzger said about conjectural emendations, but you didn't read the rest of the context where he said this should only, you know, rarely or very carefully can be applied in the New Testament. Yeah, okay, I'm not quoting, you know, 3, 4, 5 pages. I'm just going to quote some salient paragraphs here and there. So I'm aware it has a larger context, but I think that the quotations will speak for themselves. So then, after I do that, I want to go and ask a historical question, and that is, and I truly, I don't have necessarily a predetermined answer. I'm interested in this. I mean, one thing about this podcast has been it's often been a place for me to just air my thoughts as I'm thinking through these things. I'm a student of these things, like many of you. And my question is, did the pre-modern Reformed ministers, like a Calvin, like a Beza in particular, did they have the same view of conjectural emendation as advocated by people who hold to the modern text critical method? And I want to look at the end in particular more closely at what Beza said about Revelation 16:5 in his notes, in his annotations within his text. So let's start with part one, which is a survey of comments on the method or the notion of conjectural emendation in modern text criticism. So I'm going to start with Westcott and Hort's Introduction to the New Testament Greek in the Original, which was published in 1882, along with the publication of their New Testament in the Original Greek, which was the groundbreaking modern critical text of the Greek New Testament. And this, I have the Hendrickson reprint from 1988. Again, the original is 1882. And so let me just read a little bit of what is found there on this topic. In part two, which is called The Methods of Textual Criticism, and within that section, Roman numeral 6, it talks about criticism as dealing with errors antecedent to existing texts. So it's assuming that we've got the texts that we have that are extant, but it assumes that prior to those texts, since we can't go back to the autographs, that is somewhere in that line of transmission in the antecedent texts, there were errors in transmission. And so in section 6, it's broken into two parts. The first part has to do with what Westcott and Hort call primitive errors. And the second part is devoted to removal of primitive errors by conjecture. And here's a quote from page 66. It says, "The utmost result that can be obtained under this condition," and here's my explanation of that, "given the existence of textual variants, the utmost result that can be obtained under this condition is the discovery of what is relatively original, whether the readings thus relatively original were also the readings of the autograph is another question which can never be answered in the affirmative with absolute decision except where the autograph itself is extant, but which admits of approximate answers varying enormously in certainty according to the nature of the documentary evidence for the text generally," end quote. And so this is the beginning discussion, and what he says at the outset is just one of the criticisms that I've held up numerous times in modern critical method, is that it offers in the end only uncertainty. It can say we think we have the text, but it says what we have is only an approximation because of these antecedent so-called primitive errors that are there. We'll never really be able to recover the text as it was unless we uncover the autograph. Then on page 71, they continue, quote, "In discussing the corruption of texts antecedent to extant documents, the forms in which it presents itself and the nature of the critical process by which it is affirmed, we have reserved till last a brief notice of the critical process which endeavors to remedy it, that is, conjectural emendation. The evidence of corruption is often irresistible, imposing on an editor the duty of indicating the presumed unsoundness of the text, although he may be wholly unable to propose any endurable way of correcting it, or have to offer only suggestions in which he can place full confidence," end quote. So he says one of the methods, Westcott would say one of the methods that the modern text critic must use is conjectural emendation, even if the suggestions he makes for how a hopelessly corrupted text is to be corrupted can only be tentative, and they can only be suggestive. They continue, quote, "The place of conjectural emendation in the textual criticism of the New Testament is, however, so inconsiderable that we should have hesitated to say even this much about it," end quote. That's page 72. And again, they say, and I will, want to make that plain, they say, hey, the modern text critic should only, rarely use conjectural emendation. The number of places in the New Testament where this needs to be used is very small, and the critic should use it very hesitantly, very carefully. Agreed, but it's part of the methodology. Even if it's to be used hesitantly and carefully, it is part of the bedrock methodology. And this is what I found curious about James White, who is embracing wholeheartedly modern text criticism, but he seems to not be embracing what Westcott and Hort say is essential to reconstructing the text because there are antecedent primitive errors. Proceeding in Westcott and Hort's introduction to the New Testament Greek and the original, this is from part 3. which is the application of principles of criticism to the texts of the New Testament. And within that, part three, there is chapter Roman numeral 4, which is titled Substantial Integrity of the Purest Transmitted Text. So here is another quotation, relevant quotation from this section. Quote, "The way has now been cleared for the final question. Is it or is it not reasonable to expect that in any considerable number of cases, the true reading has now perished? Have we a right to assume that the true reading always exists somewhere among existing documents? The question is often foreclosed on one or both of two grounds, which in our judgment are quite irrelevant. First, some think it incredible that any true words of Scripture have perished. In reply, it is a sufficient argumentum ad hominem to point to the existence of various readings forming part of the various texts accepted for long ages, and the frequent difficulty of deciding between them, even though we say nothing of difficulties of interpretation. On any view, many important churches for long ages have had only an approximately pure New Testament, so that we have no right to treat it as antecedently incredible that only an approximately pure New Testament should be attainable now, or even in all future time. For ourselves, we dare not introduce considerations which could not reasonably be applied to other ancient texts, supposing them to have documentary attestation of equal amount, variety, and antiquity. Secondly, the folly and frivolity of once popular conjectures have led to a wholesome reaction against looking beyond documentary tradition." End quote. That's pages 276 and 277. So here, this is really very telling for Westcott and Hort. They've abandoned completely any idea of providential preservation of Scripture. They're looking at it completely naturalistically, and they're saying we can't apply anything to the New Testament we wouldn't apply to any other ancient work. And they basically say we shouldn't have some sort of, you know, dogmatic idea that the pure reading, the true reading of Scripture, cannot possibly perish. They said that's infantile. Yes, it can perish, and we have to acknowledge that, and we can only then approximate as best we can what the pure text was. And again, this is a very, very, very different worldview than that was held by the framers of the Reformed confessions, like the Westminster Confession of Faith and the Second London Baptist Confession. Westcott and Hort were Anglicans anyway, so they wouldn't have held to this. But it's amazing how many evangelicals and even Calvinists and even so-called Reformed evangelicals have embraced this approach to Scripture, believing it to have been corrupted and then needing restoration, as opposed to the preservationist view that was held by the confessional framers of the great Protestant confessions. Here's another quotation. This is page 282. It says, quote, Westcott and Hort say, quote, "It will not be out of place to add here a distinct expression of our belief that even among the numerous unquestionably spurious readings of the New Testament, there are no signs of deliberate falsification of the text for dogmatic purposes," end quote. And this is something that gets picked up by a lot of evangelical apologists. They will concede there are textual transmission issues of the New Testament, but none of them involve any doctrinal issues. You know, just look away. This doesn't involve doctrine. And here they're saying that the texts were not tampered with for doctrinal purposes. Bart Ehrman, when he came along with his book, The Orthodox Corruption of Scripture, nullified this by saying that there were doctrinal issues related to the text. He sort of flips it up on its head and says, no, the problem wasn't, you know, Arians tampering the text. The problem was Orthodox scholars tampering with the text. But here you see Westcott and Hort denying that there were any doctrinal issues related to textual differences. Let's see. Here's another quote. Quote, the text of this edition, of course, makes no pretension to be more than an approximation of the purest text that might be formed from existing materials, end quote, page 284. And again, that is at the heart of those who embrace the modern text critical method. They can only give, as Westcott and Hort put it, an approximation of the purest text. And then they add, page 286, quote, there is no royal road to the ascertainment of the true texts of ancient writings, end quote. So there you have Westcott and Hort. Conjectural emendations must be part of the method because there were primitive errors antecedent to the extant texts, and sometimes the scholars will have to, very rarely, hesitantly, but sometimes they will have to appeal to this. Well, you might say, okay, that was Westcott and Hort. Let's go a little forward, and I want to look at a quotation from B.B. Warfield, Benjamin Warfield, and his book, An Introduction to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament. The copy that I have is the third edition of this from 1886, and in chapter 3 of Warfield's work, titled The Praxis of Criticism, he addresses the whole issue of conjectural emendation. Here's a quote from him, page 207, quote, before we close our discussion of the praxis of criticism, therefore, we must explicitly recognize the legitimacy and duty of examining the text of the whole New Testament with the most scrupulous care, with a view to discovering whether its transmission has been perfect, and of appealing to internal evidence to suggest and settle for us the true text in all cases of variation where the evidence is hopelessly in conflict, and in all cases where the absence of variation and examination of the text has resulted in leading us to suspect corruption. Then a little later it says, the technical name given to this extension of criticism is conjectural emendation, which is meant to describe it as a process which suggests the emendation which the text is shown either by the presence of irreconcilable variations or by internal considerations to need from the conjecture of the mind working on internal hints. That's the end of the quote. And he says a lot more. I wish I could read more from pages 207 to 210. And he does say, this is on page 209, he says, few as the passages are that can be shown to need conjecture to settle their text, the passages in which successful conjectures have been made are still fewer. So much like Westcott and Hort, he says, hey, there are very few places where this needs to be applied in the New Testament. And yet the point I want to emphasize is that conceptually, conjectural emendation has always been thought of as an essential part of modern text criticism. And it's there in, you know, an evangelical, Calvinistic, Reformed author like B.B. Warfield. And of course, Warfield had a huge impact on evangelicals, the whole development of the idea of the inerrancy of the original autographs, and he really departed from the Westminster view, I think, of the preservation of Scripture. He did it in order to battle apologetically against modernists, but I think he gave away the store. I would refer you to some of the things that Theodore Letus has written about the problems with Warfield's apologetic method. Okay, so we've looked at Westcott and Hort. We've looked at B.B. Warfield. Let's next look at Bruce Metzger. His classic work, The Text of the New Testament, is subtitled is Transmission, Corruption, and Restoration. The first edition of this goes back to 1968 from Oxford University Press, actually 1964. second edition 1968, third edition 1992, and then the 2005 edition, the current edition, was co-edited with Bart Ehrman. Here's another interesting thing. You know, people like James White, Michael Kruger, D.A. Carson, others who embrace modern text criticism, they love to say, no, we're defending orthodoxy against Bart Ehrman. But then they're sold out completely to Bruce Metzger and modern text criticism. But who ended up becoming the editor of Metzger's work? Well, his doctoral student, Bart Ehrman, is the real heir to this method, not evangelicals who use the same method, but Bart Ehrman. Anyways, let's look at dip in a few places. And again, I'm not going to do justice. I like to read, you know, probably about 10 pages from this. It's all worth reading. But let me just dip in at a few places from Ehrman, Metzger and Ehrman. This is from chapter 6, which is Modern Methods of Textual Criticism. And from page 205, they write, quote, "The method of textual criticism that has been generally practiced by editors of classical Greek and Latin texts involves two main processes, recension and emendation. Recension is the selection, after examination of all available material, of the most trustworthy evidence on which to base a text. Emendation is the attempt to eliminate the errors that are found even in the best manuscripts," end quote. And so what they're saying is, again, they're saying, hey, we're doing text criticism of the New Testament, but we're using methods that were developed in the study of secular Greek and Latin texts. And there are two things. There's recension, that's simply selecting among the available materials that which is most trustworthy. And then there's also emendation, which is correcting the errors, restoring the corrupted text. That's the third word in the subtitle of their book. The text of the New Testament, it's transmission, corruption, and restoration. There's an extended discussion of conjectural emendation found on pages 226 to 231. And again, you would do well to read all of that. But here's part of what is said there. Quote, "The classical method of textual criticism regularly involves, as was mentioned at the beginning of this chapter," the quote I read earlier, "the exercise of conjectural emendation." Let me read this again. "The classical method of textual criticism regularly involves, as was mentioned at the beginning of this chapter, the exercise of conjectural emendation. If the only reading, or each of several variant readings that the documents supply, is impossible or incomprehensible, the editor's only remaining resource is to conjecture what the original reading must have been," end quote. That's found on pages 226 to 227. And then on page 229, they add, quote, "In their edition of the Greek New Testament, Westcott and Hort marked with obeli, a special marking, about 60 passages that they, or one of them, suspected involved a primitive error. That is, an error older than the extant witnesses, for the removal of which one is confined to conjectural emendation," end quote. So they point out, Westcott and Hort said there are at least 60 passages in the New Testament where there's this antecedent primitive error. And basically, we don't know what the reading should be. They used obeli. By the way, in the modern handbook in Nestle 28th, they're now using a black diamond to mark out these same places where they say we've got a place in the text where we're not sure what it should be. Here are several possibilities, and the person reading this is going to have to just make their best judgment about it. Let's see, page 230. They go on to say, quote, one must admit the theoretical legitimacy of applying to the New Testament a process that has so often been found essential in the restoration of the right text in classical authors. But the amount of evidence for the text in the New Testament, whether derived from manuscripts, early versions, or patristic quotations, is so much greater than that available for any ancient classical author that the necessity resorting to emendation is reduced to the smallest dimensions. End quote. So again, as Westcott and Hort said, as B.B. Warfield says, yes, there because we've got so much evidence for the New Testament, much more than many other classical works, and we have early translations, versions, we've got patristic quotations, this only has to be used sparingly. But the key thing here is, they're stressing it, it's part of the methodology. It's essential to the methodology. Finally, let me look at a quotation from Howard Greenlee. His work is pretty popularly used, although I think less so as time goes on, it's being replaced by other works. But his Introduction to New Testament Textual Criticism, the original was in 1964. I'm looking at the revised edition of 1995. On page 5, Greenlee says, quote, "If examining the available manuscripts fails to indicate satisfactorily the original text of a certain word or phrase, a scholar may resort to an," and he puts in quotation marks, "educated guess known as a conjectural emendation. In the case of literature, where there are only a few extant manuscripts, this procedure may sometimes be necessary. When a large number of manuscripts are available, as in the case of the New Testament, conjecture is less often, if ever, necessary, and tends to become what Kenyon called," is another quote, "a process precarious in the extreme and seldom allowing anyone but the guesser to feel confidence in the truth of its results." And that's the end of the Kenyon quote and the end of the quote from Greenlee, page 5. So, similar to what we saw before, yes, conjectural emendation is a necessary part of classical text criticism. In the case of the New Testament, it should only rarely be used, but it's still in the methodological toolbox. And again, that's one reason why I was surprised to hear what James White said at the end of that lecture, and I'd love to hear him say more about that, because it seems like he's taking a pretty significant departure from what has been ordinarily accepted. I wonder, he's working on a PhD, and is this going to cause conflict with his advisor if he's wanting to work in this and not following the classical modern text critical method? So that's the first thing I want to do. Is I just want to survey that. I'm still quotation hunting on that and trying to understand it better. The second thing I want to do now is I want to look at the historical question about whether or not pre-modern ministers, scholarly ministers, who had a hand in printing, collecting, and printing some of the early Greek texts, the Textus Receptus, whether they shared the same views on conjectural emendations as that was shared in modern text criticism. Clearly, again, conjectural emendation is a standard aspect of modern text criticism, as it has typically been practiced. But again, what about in the pre-modern era? And I'm preaching right now through the Gospel of John on Sunday mornings, and I'm simultaneously reading John Calvin's commentary on John. And as I've been reading through it, I'll be preaching tomorrow, in fact, on the end of John 18, Christ's trial before Pontius Pilate. But as I've been reading through the commentary, in parallel with this, my preaching, I've been taking note of what Calvin has to say about text criticism, and I hope eventually that I'm going to then collect all the notes that I've taken. It's really been a year and a half. I've been preaching through John. When I finish John, I'm going to take the notes that I've collected and try to put it into an article something like Calvin's view of the text of John as reflected in his commentary or something like that. And I did run across a place in John 18:1, in Calvin's commentary on John 18:1, where he questions whether the what he calls the text in the Greek original came about through some transmissional error, and it's whether it has to do with the article before the word Kedron, when it talks about the Lord going over the brook Kedron after he leaves the upper room and he goes to the garden where he's going to be arrested. So, but this is a matter of, you know, what is the proper article? And it's interesting, I'm reading the Calvin Translation Society version of Calvin's commentaries, translation of Calvin's commentaries, and the editor there calls in the notes there what Calvin was doing a conjectural emendation, and I it seems to be reflecting the spirit of the age. Again, I'm not completely convinced yet that that's what Calvin was actually doing, but more germane for this ongoing discussion about Revelation 16:5 and Theodore Beza, my question is, would Theodore Beza in 1598 have had the same view on conjectural emendation that Westcott and Hort had in the 1880s, that B.B. Warfield had at the end of the 19th century in 1886, that Bruce Metzger had in 1964, the practitioners of the coherence-based genealogical method have in 2019. What did he have that same view? And as I was thinking about that, I came to my mind the discussion about Erasmus and Erasmus's leaving out of the first two editions of his printed Greek New Testament the three heavenly witness passage, the Coma Johanneum, and so in his TR 15:16-15:19, he left out the Coma Johanneum, three heavenly witnesses passage, and he was criticized for this omission by the Protestant Edward Lee in England, and also by the Roman Catholic Stunica of Spain, and eventually, in the third edition, 1522, he included the Coma Johanneum. And the reason he didn't put it in the first two editions was apparently because it was not in the Greek manuscripts that he was consulting. And so he didn't put it in there until he had a Greek manuscript that he read that showed it in the text. And I'm reading right now Grantley MacDonald's book called Biblical Criticism in Early Modern Europe. And here's a quotation from him, page 19. He says, quote, "Had he found one Greek manuscript with the Coma, he certainly would have added the missing phrase from that one textual witness. But since that had not happened, he had no choice but to indicate that the Coma was absent from the Greek manuscripts available to him," end quote. Now, I want you to note well here, I am not affirming the legendary rash wager anecdote that's often told about Erasmus, that he made a bet. If anybody could come up with a manuscript, he would put it in there. That is a legendary tale, and there's no documentary evidence that Erasmus ever made this supposed rash wager. And you can read the article that I wrote about this called Erasmus's Anecdote, or Erasmus Anecdotes is the name, title of the article. Nevertheless, it is valid to say that Erasmus wanted his printed text of the Greek New Testament to be one that reflected readings that were found in extant Greek manuscripts, and he did eventually restore the Coma Ioanneum in the third edition of his TR, when he was satisfied that he had found such a manuscript. I'm not saying he made a wager that he would do it if he found it, but I'm saying just it was part of his method that once he found it, then he put it in there. And my point is to say, it seems that this seems to indicate, and funny enough, ironically enough, those who perpetuate the rash wager anecdote are essentially putting forward a view that Erasmus would not have made a conjecture, or even he would not have even had a reading in his text that was from a Latin manuscript or a versional manuscript or a patristic quote, that it had to be something that appeared in the Greek before he would include it in his text. So he wasn't very willing to make a conjecture based on a versional evidence, patristic evidence, and certainly not a pure conjectural limitation. A pure conjectural limitation would be one, but not based on it's there in a version or it's there in quoted by a father. It's just something that I've come up with as a logical deduction in my mind. There's certainly no hint of him having that kind of idea. So Erasmus is more a contemporary of Calvin and Beza. And so if Erasmus was unlikely to do that, I'm wondering what the likelihood is that Beza would have been prone to make a pure conjectural imitation at a place like Revelation 16:5. And so that's what I want to turn to then and just think a little bit more about this. It seems that modern writers, at least the couple that I've looked at, and I haven't looked, this is another thing, I want to look up more of what people have said about Revelation 16:5. It seems that modern writers assume that Beza made a pure conjectural emendation at Revelation 16:5. And he simply, based on his own reasoning, assumed that the reading should be ha esamenos, that God is the one who is and who was and who will be, rather than the reading that appears in the majority of extant Greek manuscripts, ha hasias, the Lord who is and was holy, the Holy One. I said even conservative men, Hills in the King James Version defended, on page 208, suggests that Beza simply made a conjectural imitation at Revelation 16:5. But I went back again, and I looked at Beza's notes, his annotations in that 1598 New Testament, and I think I pointed this out previously. It seems to me, looking at that paragraph or so there, and I have not yet translated the entire thing, but the key sentence seems to be this one, and I'm going to read it here as it appears in Latin, and my pronunciation is going to be atrocious. I will, again, go to jeffriddle.net, and you can read it for yourself. But here's the Latin. Etaque ambigere non possum, quin germana sit scriptura quam ex vetusto bona fide manuscripto codice restitui nempe ha esamenas. And so the question is, what was Beza saying in that sentence? How is it to be translated? Now, James White, in his book, The King James Version Only Controversy, and in particular, I noticed when I compared the original 1995 edition to the new expanded edition, he definitely put a whole lot more in there about Revelation 16:5. And he includes some facsimiles of some different texts, printed texts of Revelation 16:5. He put a lot into this. This is what he says. This is, let's see, this is from the 2009 edition, page 237. James White says, quote, "So why does the KJV read and shall be?" That is, why does it have a reading based on the text being ha esamenas instead of ha hasias? Because, he says, back to James White. John Calvin's successor at Geneva, Theodore Beza, conjectured that the original reading differently, and I put a sick there because it's a typo there. That clause doesn't make sense. But anyways, continuing, he says, White says, to use his words, ex vetusto bona fide manuscripto codice restitui. And then James White continues, Beza believed that there was sufficient similarity between the Greek terms hasios and esamenos, the future form shall be, to allow him to make the change to harmonize the text with other such language in Revelation. And then he puts in italic, but he had no manuscript evidence in support of his conjecture, end quote. So this is something that James White makes much of. And the very sentence, Latin sentence that I quoted, he also rightly sees as the key sentence in Beza's note. But my question is, what exactly did Beza say? And interesting enough, even, I think last time or... and last time I was addressing this in Word Magazine 115, I did a review of the KJV Today article on Beza in Revelation 16:5. And there, the authors of that article, even though they're defending the King James Version and ostensibly the Textus Receptus, they also concede, hey, Beza made a conjecture here. And they say it's okay to make conjectures, and here's why. Even Metzger made conjectures, and they have a quote from Metzger about the validity of conjectures. But what I found interesting was the translation that they offer there of Beza's note. And here is, as far as I can figure out, what the translation they give for the Latin sentence that I read earlier, and part of which James White quotes. I know this is getting kind of complicated. I think if you get confused, go to jeffriddle.net and look at the blog post for WM 117, and you can see it written out. So anyways, here's their translation, the KJV Today article, the anonymous author of that article. Here's his translation. And so, without doubting the genuine writing in this ancient manuscript, I faithfully restored in the good book what was certainly there, ha esamenos. And I puzzled over that translation. It didn't seem to make sense to me. So I want to go back, and tedious as this may be, I want to look at that one sentence, key sentence from Beza, and let me read it again in Latin. Itaque ambigere non possum, quin germana sit scriptura quam ex vetusto bona fide manuscripto codice restitui nempe ha esamenas. And I'm going to go through and let me just break down. I'm not an expert in Latin. I took some Latin in college. And I actually teach my taught my children out of a college level textbook. I've taught them Latin, my older children who are in college, and I'm teaching my two younger boys. So anyways, but I'm not an expert, and I may be rendering it wrong, and I hope maybe somebody out there, if I'm doing it rendering it wrong, please correct me. So here though is my breakdown of this sentence. Okay, first we've got itaque, which is an adverb, means therefore. Then we've got a present active infinitive verb, ambigere, from ambigo, which means to doubt. Then we've got non possum. Non is a negative particle, possum is the verb to be, and it's present active indicative, first person, singular, I am not able, non possum, I am not able. Then we've got the word quin, which is the combination of the pronoun qui and the negative suffix ne, And you put those together, it would be Queen A, but this is an abbreviated form. It's just Quinn. And looked up in the dictionary, it says it's used in subordinate clauses with the subjunctive verb. And after negative verbs of doubting, it means something like, in English, but that. And then there is the adjective Germana, which is in the nominative feminine singular form, meaning the word means true. And it's modifying here the word scriptura. Then there is the verb sit, which is a present active subjunctive, third person singular, from the verb esse, to be. So it's in the subjunctive, it should be. Scriptura, again, is a nominative feminine singular, meaning a writing, a piece of writing, or then it could also mean a reading, a piece of writing to be read. Then you've got quam, the comparative adverb, meaning as. Then you've got ex, which is a preposition, which means, of course, out of. And the preposition ex in Latin takes its object in the ablative case. Then you've got vetusto, which is an adjective. It's a masculine ablative singular. Here it's modifying the noun codice, and it means ancient. Then you've got the phrase boni fide. Boni is an adjective, genitive feminine singular, from bonus, bona, bonum. Here modifying fide, meaning good. Fide is a genitive feminine singular noun. Fides means trust. Then you've got the word manuscripto, which is an adjective, actually masculine ablative singular. The adjective is manuscriptus, manuscripta, manuscriptum. Here, modifying the noun codice, it means something that's handwritten. And then you've got the noun, which is the object of the preposition ex. It's codice. It's in the masculine ablative singular. It's the object of the preposition. And the codice is the ablative, but the standard dictionary form in the nominative would be codex, meaning book. And then you've got the verb restitui, which is a perfect active indicative first person singular from restituo, which means to restore. And then you've got the adverb nempe, which means truly or certainly. And then you've got the very end, the Greek word ha esamenos, which shall be. So let me read it again. Itaque ambigere non possum quin Germana sit scriptura quam ex vetusto bona fide manuscripto codice restitui nempe ha esamenos. So here's my translation of Beza. Therefore, I am not able to doubt but that the true reading should be as I have restored it from an ancient codex manuscript of good faith, truly, ha esamenos. Let me read that again. Therefore, I am not able to doubt but that the true reading should be as I have restored it from an ancient handwritten codex of good faith, truly, ha esamenos. So, when I look at that, what Beza said is he didn't say here, hey, I logically figured out a conjecture that I couldn't find in any version, any patristic author, or in any manuscript. In fact, he says quite the opposite. He says, I have restored the proper reading, ha esamenos, ex vetusto boni fide manuscripto codice, from an ancient handwritten codex of good faith. Or a reliable one. Now, what was that ancient handwritten codex? We do not know. I don't know what Beza had, but it seems to me, in reading this in the Latin, unless I've missed something, somebody tell me if I missed something, is Beza never says he makes a pure conjecture there. He says he was relying on a handwritten codex. assuming a Greek codex. And that's where he got the reading. Do we have that codex now? No. Where is it? I don't know. It may still exist somewhere. It may be discovered. It may have been lost. But the reading is preserved by Beza. And that reading was thought to be appropriate by some people, like the translators of the King James Version. So I know we've kind of gone way afield, and I want to continue and translate the entirety of Beza's note. And it's possible I misunderstood it. Again, I will stand corrected. Someone will point out my error in my translation. So let me offer a couple conclusions now that we've done those two things. We gave the review of the use of the method of conjectural emendation in modern text criticism, and we talked a little bit about historically how people like Erasmus, Calvin, and most particularly Beza, what would they have thought of conjectural emendations as they're understood in the modern sense, and in particular did Beza used such a thing at Revelation 16:5. So here are two conclusions. First, conjectural emendation is a necessary aspect of the reconstructionist modern historical critical method with relationship to text criticism. It is based on the notion that the true text is irretrievably lost and can therefore at points only be hypothetically approximated. So if someone like James White, says that they affirm modern text criticism, but then they reject the use of conjectural emendations, it seems to me that that is inconsistent. That's not being consistent with the method that you have embraced. Second observation, based on my translation of Beza's note, and this one sentence in particular, it seems to be very important, I think a question is raised in my mind, at least. And again, I stand to be corrected if I'm wrong. I don't think it defeats an argument for the validity of Revelation 16:5 as it is in Beza's text necessarily. The KJV Today article writer, made an argument for it based, assuming it was a pure conjectural emendation. But my reading of what Beza wrote raises in my mind a question as to whether we could even call his own discussion of his decision to embrace the reading Haesamonos that he did, whether we have to raise a question as to whether or not it was based on a conjectural emendation. He says, James, oddly enough, James White quotes it, but he doesn't translate it. Did he not understand it? I don't know. But I mean, look at what he said. He said he got it ex vetusto boni fide manuscripto codice, from an ancient handwritten manuscript of good faith, of reliability. And so that makes me think that his reading at Revelation 16:5 is not by any conventional definition a pure conjectural emendation. Well, this I got a little bit complicated. I'm glad I finally got a chance to sit down and share some of these notes. I will, again, put this up at jeffriddle.net. Hope you'll take a look at it. And I do offer, or I'm open to corrections, comments, if you want to send them my way. I hope you've enjoyed this issue of Word Magazine, and I'll look forward to speaking to you down the road in the next one. Till then, take care, and God bless.